dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the very important battle spaces in that war, and one that may move into the kinetic zone here very shortly, is, of course, the nation of Iran, and more broadly, the waters off its coasts, the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, the Arabian Sea. There is, as of this morning, reporting that an incident has taken place off the coast of the United Arab Emirates in which four ships have been subjected to sabotage attacks, we're told. The exact nature of those attacks and the source of them is yet to be made known. But to assess what the implications of this might be, I wanted to speak quickly with one of our duty experts on all things naval and intelligence. He is a specialist, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, in which he served as the director of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet in his last duty station at the end of a very distinguished 30-year career in the United States Navy. His name is, of course, Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. These days he's with the Geneva Center for Security Policy as a fellow. Jim, thank you so much for taking a few minutes, a very quick call here, just to sort of assess what we know so far and what we might make of this incident.
Good morning, Frank. Yes, looks to be a very serious escalation in a situation in the Gulf. From the early reporting right now, I mean, as you said, the details are still being fleshed out. But initial reports I'm seeing say that at least two of the ships have observed holes in them. So it looks like it was some kind of kinetic attack, given the statements from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander that, you know, the presence of the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf would be considered a threat. And that the U.S. Navy ships would be a target. This seems to be a very clear escalation of the situation. While not directly against U.S. warships, the UAE happens to be an allied friend of us. And Secretary of State Pompeo had said over the weekend that, you know, any action taken by Iran that would affect American interests, whether they be in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, or any place in the Middle East, we are prepared to respond in an appropriate way. I mean, this clearly seems to be an escalation.
You have also brought to my attention that some Iranian mullahs have, in the past day or so, been talking up the idea of attacks on shipping in the Persian Gulf. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, their statements said that that you know the presence of the United States in the Gulf was a threat to Iran, and that they wanted us to leave the region, and that, you know, that they would consider taking the U.S. Navy as a target of opportunity. So we clearly an escalation.
The escalation piece of this is interesting to me because at the moment we don't know who did this. Circumstantial evidence certainly would point to Iran. They would be the principal beneficiary of this. But Jim Fennell, one of the things that I wanted to sort of explore with you is that knowing the ways of the maritime world as you do, whether this might not be a pretty clever way to ratchet up the pressure on the United States and, for that matter, the world economy without actually having Iranian fingerprints all over it. An attack on U.S. Navy vessels, of course, would be very sporty, a casus belli, as they say, as would, I think, shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians have also threatened to do. But what would be the effect, for example, on insurance rates for shipping in the Persian Gulf if there were these sorts of attacks taking place? And what would the impact of that likely be on the willingness of people who own those ships to send them into such waters?
Well, as you correctly point out, the the cause of this attack has to be investigated and determined. So I think in the immediate near term, it may not affect international shipping, especially as it relates to the Gulf supply of oil to Europe and the rest of the world. But if this investigation were to confirm that Iran was responsible, or if there was another attack, maybe not inside the waters of the UAE or in Port Fujairah, but if it occurred somewhere in the Strait, then it would certainly spook the market, if you like to put it that way, and cause shippers to really reconsider, you know, what are they going to do? And it would bring us back to the late 80s and the escort operations that the U.S. Navy did and under Operation Praying Mantis, kind of a construct.
This, it's important to understand that we have faced some of these sorts of threats in the past, and the Navy has been assigned the job of keeping the straits open, keeping the shipping flowing, particularly the oil shipping. We fortunately are in a rather different position today as a nation, now being a net exporter of energy from where we were back then. But our allies around the world remain critically dependent upon this source of oil, as do other countries like China, for that matter. Do you anticipate, Jim, that we would see the Navy thrown into this role? And if so, that given the relatively small size of the fleet, compared even to the 1980s when we did that mission, this would be rather stressful for our naval forces.
There's no question that this would place an additional level of effort on our fleet resources, and continue to do the other areas that we're covering today in the Middle East, or in the Far East, and even in Europe right now. So it is a challenge for us. I think this is an existential reaction to the Iranian deal and Iran's desire not to allow the deal to go away. And so they're trying to force a situation where somehow Western Europe or Europe in general are going to try to lean on the United States and Russia and China to comply or bring this deal back so that they can be allowed to continue to operate under that construct. And I don't see that happening. So it's another reason why we need to have a bigger Navy in the United States. And it's also right now, I'd say if I was in the Fifth Fleet AOR in the Middle East and CENTCOM, I'd be very nervous right now.
Yeah. Well, this is the area of responsibility where, of course, we may well have a shooting war going on here shortly. We're not seeking it, but it may be the Iranians' intention to precipitate one. Jim Fennell, thank you very much, as always, for your time, your expertise, and your continuing service to our country now at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. But we're always grateful for your insights and look forward to talking with you in the next few days further about China. Thank you for joining us today. Next up, we'll talk with Hans von Spakovsky about the so-called constitutional crisis the Democrats seem to be manufacturing on Capitol Hill. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm pleased to say we are joined by Hans von Spakovsky, better known to all of us as HVS, a man who has done hugely important work both in government, including as the special assistant to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the George W. Bush administration, as well as in his present role as a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center. It's a great honor to have him with us to talk about things that he's been focusing on for some time now, including topics of two terrific books he's written or co-authored, one, Obama's Enforcer, about Eric Holder, and the other, who's counting, about voting fraud. Hans, I wanted to ask you first and foremost, having studied closely Eric Holder's tenure in the Justice Department, there are comparisons being made between the efforts the Republicans in Congress made to try to extract information from Eric Holder and what Democrats are now trying to do to try to extract information from his successor, the incumbent Attorney General William Barr. Would you compare and contrast for the present purpose what the differences are and whether this current tempest in a teapot, it seems to me, amounts to, as is being claimed by the Democrats, a constitutional crisis?
Yeah, it's interesting to do a comparison because in 2012, Eric Holder was the first Attorney General in history to be held in contempt, but he was held in contempt. Why? Well, because at the time it was discovered that the Justice Department was running probably the most reckless law enforcement operation it had ever put together. Is in essence a gun smuggling operation into Mexico that led not only to the death of an American border agent, but to the deaths of hundreds of American citizens. And when Congress started investigating this, Eric Holder asked the president, President Obama, to claim executive privilege, and they used that to prevent documents and information about Operation Fast and Furious from being given to Congress. Contrast that with the situation here, where almost the entire Mueller report, virtually the entire Mueller report, was turned over to Congress, even though the Attorney General actually doesn't have an obligation under the law to do so. The report that was released to the public, only about 8% of it was redacted. The special version sent over to congressional leaders only had about 2% redacted. And Democrats keep complaining about that 2%, but that 2% was redacted. Why? Not because the Attorney General wanted to do it, but because he's obligated to do it because grand jury evidence, grand jury information by federal law is secret and cannot be turned over to Congress or anyone else. So they're in essence criticizing him for complying with federal law.
Now, I heard Adam Schiff, the somewhat notorious chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, making the argument on a show this morning to the effect that, well, Jeff Sessions worked with the Congress to go to a federal judge and get permission to make such sensitive information available, and that there's no reason why Barr couldn't do that as well and get around this natty issue of the law. Do you know what he's talking about, and does that make any sense to you?
I think there are certain exceptions that a court can order. This is not one of them. And in fact, only a month ago, and this hasn't, I haven't seen this covered. Listen, only about a month ago, a federal court in Washington, D.C., in a completely unrelated case, said that the federal courts have no inherent power to waive that grand jury secrecy requirement.
Wow. Adam Schiff didn't mention that. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So the bottom line, I guess, on this is that the Attorney General of the United States is being held in contempt at the moment by congressional Democrats that are waging political warfare against this president and his administration, and that he's well within his rights to do so, and he is being hectored and vilified, for that matter, simply to try to bring down this administration, having failed to do so through the Mueller report process. That's my words, not yours, but does that about capture the thought?
Oh, no, I think that's exactly it. And it's actually even much worse than that because, look, he's been held in contempt, and most people think, well, it's only because he refused to turn over the 2% of the Mueller report that was redacted. No, the subpoena that Chairman Nadler, the Judiciary Committee, sent over, it asked for literally millions of pages of documents because they don't just want the Mueller report. They want absolutely every piece of information and every document that the entire Mueller team possesses, which is just nutty. It's as if they want to say, well, you decided the president shouldn't be prosecuted. We in Congress, we're going to act as if we're a Justice Department and we want everything you've got. That they're not entitled to.
Yeah, we're a Justice Department and a special prosecutor, I think it's fair to say. A redo, it looks like. So Hans, as you're exploring this, you have indicated in a recent piece that you wrote with Cully Stimson about the House Democrats having contempt rather than the Attorney General. And the contempt, in your words, is for the Constitution itself. Walk us through that.
Well, it's very clear in all the actions they're taking that they're basically trying to go outside of the powers that Congress is given under the Constitution. And that, I think, shows their contempt for it. And I mean, I'll give you another example that's, you know, that's it's not the Mueller report, but it's somewhat related. And remember, the House Ways and Means Committee is also demanding copies of the president's tax returns from the IRS. Well, federal law makes such tax returns confidential. And while there is a statute that under limited circumstances gives this committee access to tax returns, there has to be a legislative purpose behind it. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that on numerous occasions, and it has also told the Congress that you can't investigate someone, you can't demand documents and information from them simply because you don't like them and you want to expose them. That is far beyond your powers. And you know what the most, I find it ironic, but the Supreme Court decision in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that, guess who they told it to? They told it to the House Un-American Activities Committee being chaired by Joe McCarthy.
Interesting. Let me switch gears with you, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. As I mentioned, you are a duty expert, both as an author of Who's Counting and as a former member of the Federal Elections Commission, about the phenomenon of voting fraud. We are endlessly told by people on the left that there is no such thing as voting fraud in America, and I know you don't agree with that, but there have been now a number of cases, including here in Texas, where I am at the moment, in which federal candidates, or most recently a candidate for mayor, seem to have had fraudulent operations run against them at the ballot box, and the result was that they lost their positions. Can you just give us an update as you see it as to where we are? You worked for a time on the commission that the president established shortly after the election to explore all this. That didn't last very long, but is that because the problem has actually gone away or we're simply not allowed to know about it?
No, it's more we're not allowed to know about it. That commission of the president's, which he had appointed to look into the vulnerabilities in our system and look at the election integrity situation, it was dissolved because as soon as the commission was fully constituted, a dozen lawsuits were filed by the progressive left, organizations funded by George Soros and others, to try to prevent it from operating, because they didn't even want simple research done, which is simply what they were going to do to find out, you know, the extent of the problem, what could be done about it. They didn't even want the research done over it. So no, it hasn't gone away. In fact, Frank, I'm sure everyone has seen the news. Look, we just had the results from the 2018 congressional election. We had a congressional race in North Carolina overturned because of voter fraud going on there. And that's the kind of thing that unfortunately happens far too often in other places around the country.
Well, I guess we're allowed to know about that because that was a case in which a Republican was charged with having had some voting fraud. And interestingly enough, Hans, you might just take a moment to walk through this, but what he was evidently doing is something that's perfectly legal in places where the left has used it very effectively, like California in this last election cycle, no? This so-called vote harvesting deal?
Right. No, that's exactly right. And vote harvesting is when people beside your family are allowed to pick up your absentee ballot and deliver it. Well, you know, what does that do? That, of course, puts it in the hands of party activists and political consultants. And what happened in the North Carolina case was that this guy was being paid by this Republican candidate who's now been indicted for felonies. They were picking up blank ballots from voters and then filling them in, you know, with the right candidate, and it all, of course, which is highly illegal. But what's interesting about that case is this guy had been suspected of doing this previously when he was working for Democratic candidates. That information was apparently forwarded to local prosecutors by the North Carolina Board of Elections, and guess what? Nothing was done about it.
I'm shocked. Until he did it for a Republican, at which point it was used to overturn the election. Hans von Spakovsky, thank you so much for your time today and the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation. Your continuing service to our country rendered both in government and out. We really appreciate you. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, we will speak with Lawrence Peck about what's been going on in North Korea and here on behalf of one of the most odious regimes on the planet, that of Kim Jong-un. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the great authorities on matters involving the Far East. He is Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books dealing with various aspects of this problem: The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea. Gordon is, of course, an active contributor to the public policy debate through his columns at The Daily Beast and National Interest and elsewhere. We're always delighted to have him with us. Gordon, welcome back.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank. I don't know about great authority, but certainly I enjoyed talking to you because you absolutely move the conversation forward on critical national security issues.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. Great authority it is. Let me just ask you, Gordon, of course, since we last talked, the trade negotiations have seemingly come a cropper. President claims that that was because the Chinese were backing away from a number of the commitments that they had made in the context of course, putting the deal together. He has imposed 25% sanctions on much of what China is importing to this country and is threatening to do the same with a lot more. The Chinese have just announced that they're going to retaliate. Give us a flavor of where you think things stand and where they're likely to go from here.
Well, the talks have certainly broken down. As you point out, the Chinese have just announced retaliatory tariffs of their own on $60 billion of U.S. goods, tariffs increasing to the 25% rate that'll go into effect June 1. This is an indication that we're not going to have an agreement with China anytime soon. The real problem here, Frank, as you mentioned, is that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has withdrawn commitments that he had made. And those commitments were across the board. That infuriated American negotiators and President Trump, of course. But it's also an indication that Xi Jinping is not as powerful as many people assume. He made those commitments in the past. He had to have been in contact with his trade negotiator, the vice premier. And for him to take them back is an indication that he can no longer impose his will on elements in the Chinese political system, especially those in the state enterprises, that would be disadvantaged by the agreed trade deal with the United States. If he doesn't have that power, it must mean that there's turmoil in the political system. We are now hearing some very nationalist, even xenophobic narratives out of Beijing. That's going to make it very difficult for them to solve this. So right now we're at a point where I don't think we can expect a deal in months or maybe even years. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We should disentangle our economies from China, but I think that's where we are.
Gordon, this is fascinating. We are largely being encouraged to believe that Xi Jinping, the president for life of China, is all powerful. And the presumption I thought, given all of that, was that what was going on was a function of his decision to pull back rather than external pressure or pressure from others inside the Communist Party of China. You see it differently.
Well, I certainly do. You know, there is reporting from the Wall Street Journal, for instance, that the Chinese saw President Trump's tweet on the Federal Reserve wanting lower interest rates, and they took that as a sign that America's reported results for the economy in the first quarter were fake. And they also took that as a sign that President Trump thought the American economy was fragile. I don't think that reporting is credible, largely because the U.S. has a robust economy right now. And although people may say it's not sustainable, it clearly is strong at this moment, especially when we see the unemployment numbers come out, which are at historic lows. So the U.S. is doing really well. So I don't credit that reporting from the Wall Street Journal. I think it's much more likely, as I mentioned, that Xi Jinping was not able to exert his will over others. Of course, the Chinese political system is not transparent, but this is the one explanation that fits a number of facts that we know. But whatever it is, Frank, whatever we're seeing is that China is now not agreeing with us on commitments that it previously made. And that's a real sign, whatever the explanation is, that's a real sign that we're not going to have a trade agreement with China.
Well, I, for one, am thrilled at that prospect, Gordon. I have been concerned for some time, as you know, and others of us in the Committee on the Present Danger of China have been, that we might well see this sort of placebo effect of a trade deal causing a lessening of the concern about what China is up to across a broad front, not just in terms of its impact on our trade and technology theft and all the rest of it. This could be a very important, sort of opportunity to get China policy right. And I commend the president for his work in doing so. Hey, Gordon, let me ask you quickly about another topic on which the president's very engaged, and that is North Korea. You have written about North Korea taking on the world. The concern has been, of course, increasingly, that North Korea has the capacity to use long-range missiles and thermonuclear weapons against this country. The president was asked the other day about whether he was concerned that the North Koreans have returned to testing shorter-range missiles, and he seemed to not express any particular alarm at that, even though among the targets for such missiles would presumably be American bases in South Korea. What'd you make of that?
Yeah, I think that the president's comments about North Korea's short-range missile firings, not appropriate. There is the danger to Camp Humphreys, the newly enlarged American Army base south of Seoul, and of course, other U.S. forces in South Korea. But also, we've got to remember that any ballistic missile launch is a violation of U.N. resolutions, and we should be enforcing those. And also, it's an indication that the North Koreans have started a new cycle of provocation. And we know that the Kim family has used violence to upset status quos that it finds to be unacceptable. So all of this is a real signs of troubling breakdown in the negotiations with North Korea. And I don't think President Trump should be minimizing it. On the contrary, he should be imposing costs, because if you want to stop this cycle, you got to stop it at the beginning. So therefore, I would not have minimized what the North Koreans are doing.
Yeah. I assume that some of that is something he's being encouraged to do by the South Koreans, who, again, would be among those being targeted by the North Koreans. You've, as I said, written just recently an important book at Encounter Books about losing South Korea. Do you think that Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, this clear admirer of Kim Jong-un and his system and widely seen as trying to achieve a separate peace with him, is behind some of this lowballing by President Trump?
It could very well be, Frank. But also, we know that even without Moon Jae-in in the picture, and I agree, he's a malign actor, very pro-North Korean, very anti-American. Even without Moon Jae-in there, President Trump has said very clearly what he wants to do, and that is to give Kim this one-time shot to do the right thing. And so he's tried to encourage Kim to move in the right behavior. I think that his minimizing of the missile test is part of that strategy. But President Trump needs to pivot, because this attempt to give North Korea a favorable environment to make Kim feel secure enough to give up his weapons, this is policy has been in effect for about a year, starting from the middle of May of last year. So we're pretty close to a year. and it's not working. So I think that we need to try something that's more effective, and that would be to go back to vigorous enforcement of sanctions, because we haven't been really pushing Kim to the limit on cutting off these money flows, and we absolutely need to do that.
Boy, I couldn't agree more, Gordon Chang. Hey, there's something just came across my transom that I wanted to get your reaction to, Gordon. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a report out, I heard it on National Public Radio, I think, this morning, that there is evidence that the Chinese have been trafficking Christian girls from Pakistan as brides for young men in China for whom there simply are no women. You and I have talked about this phenomenon for some time and varying problems that could be associated with this unintended consequence of the one-child policy. Does that sound plausible to you? And if so, I take it that the Christian girls who have a pretty bleak prospect in Pakistan are likely to have an even worse one in China. Would that be right?
Yeah. Chinese criminal gangs have been kidnapping women in surrounding countries. Pakistan is not usually mentioned in this context. Most of the time you hear Burma, Mongolia, Russia, Vietnam, even North Korea. And the girls are then sold to men in bachelor villages. They're raped, forced to give birth, and then resold. I don't know if they are limiting this to Christian girls in Pakistan, but, you know, this has been going on for quite some time because, as you say, of the one-child policy. And it'll continue for as long as there are unmarriageable males in China, because the authorities in Beijing are not putting a stop to this.
Yeah. I got the impression that this was not a question of Chinese criminal gangs kidnapping the girls, but simply buying them off of desperately impoverished families in Pakistan for whom these girls have no future because they have no dowry and therefore are unlikely to be able to make their way in that country. And so it may be a variation on the theme, but it's a horror nonetheless. And I think that the concern, as you say, Gordon, is that this practice, or others for that matter, of seeking women or seeking other means of engaging these millions of young men for whom there are no women, which could be as cannon fodder, as we've talked about before, in foreign aggressive actions, is a very worrying demographic phenomenon as well as a potentially geopolitical one. Gordon, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. I appreciate your visits with us so much each week, and we look forward to ours next week. In the meantime, I know you'll keep up the great work at places like the National Interest and, of course, Daily Beast and Fox News. But we look forward to talking with you. Be well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Lawrence Peck about North Korea, deeper dive on what's going on there and what's actually happening in this country as well with respect to advocates for the North Korean in our midst. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, as promised, joined by Lawrence Peck. He is a very knowledgeable fellow with respect to both what happens on the Korean Peninsula and what is actually happening at the hands of the North Korean regime elsewhere, including in our own country. He is an advisor to the North Korean Freedom Coalition, a wonderful group headed up by our friend Suzanne Schulte. He also advises the Save Korea Foundation, which is based in Los Angeles. We're very appreciative of his time. Glad to catch up with him. It's been a while since we've talked. Lawrence, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Frank.
Well, there's a lot going on. I talked a little bit in the previous segment with Gordon Chang about his take on what the North is up to, specifically with these tests of short-range missiles. And I asked him a question that I'd like to put to you as well, Lawrence, knowing particularly the nature of the South Korean regime under Moon Jae-in and its, well, appeasement at best. At worst, it's, fellow traveling with the government of Kim Jong-un in North Korea. But what's your take on the sort of, well, dismissing by President Trump of the now resumed testing by the North Koreans of short-range missiles, which would most immediately pose a threat to South Korea, including to our forces based there for its defense?
Well, I believe that kind of downplaying of the recent tests have to do with, firstly, the desire of the administration to, if possible, in their view, save anything that's left of the outreach to the North, and secondly, to prevent more of a break with the South Korean regime of Moon, because they, meaning the South Koreans, have also been in a major way downplaying it. They won't even refer to some of the things that were fired as missiles. They're calling them projectiles.
Yes, projectiles struck me as an odd way to characterize what clearly, in some cases, were, I guess, rockets, but in other cases, equally clearly, were ballistic missiles, albeit of a short range. Is there evidence that the South Korean government is encouraging the Trump administration to, well, if not actually appease the North Koreans, as I think Moon Jae-in has been doing, at least not raise a ruckus about what the North is up to, that at the very least is at odds with the spirit of what the president's trying to do in these negotiations?
Well, there has, from the very beginning of this process, been this constant messaging from the South Korean administration, from the Moon government, indicating it was their belief and indicating trying to persuade us that the North Koreans and Kim Jong-un were fully and irrevocably on the path towards and willing to denuclearize. And of course, that's something which is in grave doubt, but that's the line that that they have been selling to us here, and some would say misrepresenting to us.
There is, I think, unmistakably a desire on the part of Moon's government in South Korea to try to effect some kind of separate peace, for want of a better term, with the North. Talk a little bit about how he's selling that to the South Korean people. Is that, in fact, a policy that is widely supported, as you see it, Lawrence Peck, or is this sort of a small clique around him who are like-minded and really operating in a way that is at odds with the desire of the vast majority of South Koreans?
Well, South Korean society is split. There are the ideological divisions that they have here, akin to the ones we have here. And there's some polls show that they the population there favors some form of continued talking or outreach to the North, but it may not necessarily be as far as supporting what Moon's long-range plans are, which are up to including continuing and restarting aid to the North, various economic projects, leading all the way up to eventually a long-term goal he has of some form of confederation with the North. In other words, his long-term goals are certainly way out ahead of what the Korean public is currently supporting, which is just a kind of continuation of a relaxation of tensions or continuation of talking.
Well, this is an issue that they are working hard, it would seem, in terms of sort of influence operations. And Lawrence, you have done extraordinarily important research into the community of people who seem to be very much aligned with the radical policies and, you know, aspirations of the North Korean dictatorship. And that's true in South Korea. We're seeing it manifested in, it seems, the growing hostility of the South Korean government to defectors, for example, and of course the concessions that the Moon government has been making rather consistently. But it's also happening here too. Could you talk about both a little bit, and what's so worrying about what the implications are of this for the kind of alliance relationship that we have long regarded as a key, you know, pillar in our security posture in Asia, as well as, of course, that of friendly nations like South Korea and Japan?
Yes, that's really a twofold issue that you've raised, and one being that you refer to the pro-North Korean activities, North Korean, what you might call influence operations here in the U.S. by U.S. residents, both Korean Americans and non-Korean Americans. But just to step back for a moment and focus a little bit on the Moon regime, South Korean government, they are doing their own lobbying within the U.S. As a matter of fact, there was a report last year that the Moon government is the number one funder of lobbying operations in the U.S., more than the Saudis or any of the other, more than Japan, more than any of the other countries who've traditionally been plowing a lot of money and efforts into lobbying here. Moon's government is now number one. And the problem with that is that not all of it is the typical kind of things you might imagine, like trade and things of that nature, but a lot of it has to do with these international security relations. And there were reports just recently in the media that they're planning a big push, the Moon administration is, to lobby the U.S. government in a major way in order to try and change U.S. official and unofficial attitudes towards the North, beginning with a big push to get us to try and ease up on our maximum pressure campaign and ease up on sanctions, which Moon and his government want to see relaxed.
And in terms of what's going on here, some of these are people that you've been tracking for a long time, Lawrence. Give us some of the names, if you can, and some of the evidence you've accumulated that suggests that these are folks working as agents of influence for the regime of North Korea.
Yes, for several decades, I've been tracking this little-known but, in my opinion, fascinating and really quite disturbing trend of pro-North Korean activities in the U.S., what really constitutes a pro-North Korean movement within the U.S., both groups, organized forces, and individuals who are members and leaders of those groups who defend, support in various ways, make excuses for the North Korean regime, and conversely attack the United States and our policies. And previously, they also attacked South Korea when it had a conservative government, but now they obviously are take a more friendly view of the current leftist regime in South Korea. But these pro-North Korean groups really fall into a couple of different categories. Some of them are what I term hardcore, openly pro-North groups, and these are mostly active in the Korean American community, and they operate in the Korean language, and their country cousins would be the American Marxist-Leninist groups, which obviously are, because they're being communist, they're supportive of the North Korean regime. Then there's a separate category, which is perhaps even more sinister because of their increased effectiveness, and those are the front groups. These are both Korean-American and non-Korean-American groups, which are not openly or publicly praising the North Korean regime or the North Korean state ideology, yet they defend the North Korean regime, they argue on behalf of them, and they really must be considered pro-North, except their modus operandi, their method of operation, their target audience is different from the openly hardcore, fanatically pro-North groups, and that these front groups have as their goal infiltrating and influencing the broader American society in political, media, academic circles.
Do you see evidence of their succeeding at that?
Well, of course, they haven't been able to change U.S. policy yet in terms of what they would really want, which are their main goals being short-term goals being a relaxation of all sanctions on the North, an end to other kinds of human rights, for example, pressure on the North, and finally the signing of a no preconditions peace agreement with the North. Their long-term goal is the removal of all U.S. forces from the Korean Peninsula and eventually the end of a U.S.-South Korean alliance.
This is an issue that we will be trying to stay on top of, Lawrence Peck, with your help. Keep on the case, my friend, and thank you for joining us. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope you will all come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. And until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.